Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Maya Katz and Suleiman Khatib, Israeli and Palestinian members of the group Combatants for Peace, who talk about the recent spike of violence in Israel and Palestine. Jessup Bonner of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who explains why a broad coalition is opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement and the next steps in the campaign to defeat the pact in the U.S. Congress. And Matthew Gardner of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who discusses a recently published report that reveals U.S.-based multinational corporations shelter $2.1 trillion in offshore accounts, avoiding $620 billion in federal taxes. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since the fall of the apartheid government in South Africa, economic inequality has surged, creating a massive wealth gap between blacks and whites. Rising inequality, by some measures, worse now than when the apartheid system fell, is also linked to a spike in violent crime. French economist Thomas Piketty, author of Capital in the 21st Century, delivering the annual Nelson Mandela Lecture at the University of Johannesburg's Soweto campus in early October, stated that two-thirds of South Africa's wealth is controlled by the top 10% of the population, which is overwhelmingly white. Piketty called for South Africa's leaders to push for a higher minimum wage in the face of double-digit unemployment and endorse new ambitious land reform programs. The French economist also called for moving away from the market-based reforms of the last decade, which he asserted failed to redistribute wealth. Inequality in South Africa is increasingly linked with rising violent crime and attacks by gangs terrorizing poor communities, where 50 people on average are murdered every day. As Eusebius McKeyser, a South African author and newspaper columnist, observed, "We've known for years there is a reliable correlation between gratuitously violent crime and inequality. Poverty, unemployment, and social cohesion are all part of the mix, but we are deeply unequal still, so the statistics don't surprise me." In the late 1990s, heavily Catholic El Salvador enacted a penal law that outlawed nearly all abortions, including when the life of a pregnant mother is at risk. Over the years, the law has been aggressively enforced, and a woman convicted of having an abortion could face 50 years in jail. According to The Nation magazine, currently 17 women sit in jail without any chance of an appeal for having a miscarriage or stillbirth. They were all convicted of aggravated homicide on highly dubious evidence. Advocates for the women, known as the 17 or Las 17, are seeking pardons for the imprisoned women. Ironically, health professionals, out of fear or caution, have reported the majority of the miscarriage cases to the police. Critics say hospital doctors, fearful of violating the draconian anti-abortion law, blame pregnant women when they arrive at the hospital hemorrhaging. Salvadoran authorities regularly use antiquated tests to argue, without valid evidence, that babies who died were born alive. The Las 17 women are jailed in the Ilopango prison, which is reportedly more than 900% over capacity. The political climate in El Salvador, even with a left-leaning president, is such that progressive politicians are finding it difficult to speak out in support of the 17, fearing retaliation in the next election. Conditions in a Google Express warehouse in Palo Alto, California, are a far cry from the fun campus environment that has attracted many young computer programmers to the internet giant. The staffing company, Adecco, that hires the workers, imposes a 2-year cap on employment and tolerates poor working conditions. Increasingly, workers are taking action against poor pay and dangerous working conditions in the back office operations at top tech corporations like Google, Apple, and eBay. To snuff out a union drive in Palo Alto, Adecco hired anti-labor management consultant Jackson Lewis. Yet the intimidation tactics failed as the workers voted to join the Teamsters Union in August. According to the news magazine In These Times, the union mobilization of back-office tech workers started when Reverend Jesse Jackson launched a public campaign to expose race and class division in Silicon Valley. The veteran civil rights leader supported a union drive by security guards at semiconductor maker Broadcom. Thus far, in 2015, the Teamsters have won 4 union campaigns in Silicon Valley, including two transport companies that serve Yahoo, Apple, and eBay. The Service Employees International Union has also initiated an organizing drive among two of the largest security staffing firms in California's high-tech valley. The union campaigns now underway in one of the nation's most lucrative industries are a test case for whether or not profits will be shared in the 21st century. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Since mid-September, 8 Israelis have been killed and 75 have been wounded in knife attacks carried out by Palestinians. During the month of October thus far, 45 Palestinians have been shot to death by the Israeli army and civilians in the West Bank, Jerusalem, and Gaza. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, more than 1,800 others have been wounded by live ammunition, rubber bullets, and beatings. Much of the violence is centered around Jerusalem, where a dispute has escalated over access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Dome of the Rock, Muslim holy sites near the Temple Mount, one of the holiest sites in Judaism. People living in the region are on edge, and there is talk of a third Palestinian intifada or uprising against Israeli occupation. As violence has escalated in Israel and Palestine, a group of former Israeli soldiers and former Palestinian fighters, known as Combatants for Peace, have been advocating a nonviolent path to end the conflict. The group was founded in 2006 following a very difficult process of trust building. In recent weeks, a small contingent of the group has been traveling throughout the U.S. that includes Suleiman Khatib, a founder of Combatants for Peace, who spent 10 years in an Israeli prison beginning at age 14 for violently opposing the Israeli occupation. Another combatant traveling in the U.S. is Maya Katz, who grew up on an Israeli kibbutz. She was present at the rally on November 4, 1995, when Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, a moment she says changed her life. She later enlisted in the Israeli army, but after her discharge, she joined Combatants for Peace. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with the pair before a recent public event in Connecticut. Here they address the current spike in violence between Israelis and Palestinians, and address the question of whether a two-state solution is still viable.
I think that unfortunately the situation in the West Bank and also inside of Israel is getting worse, and the two peoples are really frustrated from the situation right now, where there is no solution and no conversation between Israel and Palestine. And what we see now is a huge frustration, mainly from the Palestinian side. And we can see a lot of clashes between ordinary people, between Israelis and Palestinians. While as before, we could see mainly clashes between Palestinians and the IDF soldiers, now we can see a lot of riots and fights in the streets between ordinary people, between Palestinian youth and Israeli people. And I think this is a bit different. And actually, I'm a bit worried. I think that we in Combatants for Peace always show that there is another way. And even in times like this, where the two peoples are fighting each other, we try to offer an alternative. So Palestinians and Israelis in Combatants for Peace or every day on the ground, on the streets, demonstrating, meeting each other and offering the public another way of dialogue, and also another way to imagine that there is another option to end this conflict.
Basically, the violence was expected due to the fact there were no hope. There was no hope. There is no negotiation, especially for the Palestinians. There is no hope. And we will see a growing number of settlements in the Palestinian territory. So basically, if you ask many Palestinians, the majority, that they don't feel any hope with the current Israeli right-wing government. That's the truth. At the end of the day, There is no military solution for this conflict, not from the Palestinian side, not from the Israeli side. And that's what we in Combatants for Peace, as ex-fighters, ex-soldiers, ex-officers, that's what we say. That's what we experience ourselves. Unfortunately, not everybody believes what we're saying, but that's what we try all the time to influence people.
Maya Katz and then Suleiman Khatib, please share your views about whether you think a two-state solution is still possible. Do you think a one-state solution is possible?
The official statement of Combatants for Peace that we believe in two-state solution. But as time goes by, the reality is changing. And there are more and more new settlements in the West Bank. So the two populations are really mixed together. So maybe the two-state solution won't be available in the near future. So we in Combatants for Peace, we try always to think about other options. So as we say it right now, we believe in two-state solution or any other just solution that will bring Palestinians freedom and Israelis the safety and the freedom that they need.
Combatants for Peace, when it started in 2005, 2006, we did have agreement that we will support two-state solution, as the majority of our members. But due to the growing of the settlements, which has really prevented any kind of a state, so the situation changed. And now we have different members that they think differently, and we in Combatants for Peace have a space for different opinions. And so simply we will support, that's what we agree, we'll support any just peaceful solution between the Palestinians and Israelis. We work more on a grassroots level. We don't do negotiation. We try to mobilize people into a joint binational nonviolence actions and meetings and dialogue and also activism on the ground in order to make real change. And we have to do it with other organizations and cooperation with other people. We can't do it alone. But we believe in our, to imagine a different reality in our area. And we're trying our maximum to make progress and to make change. And at the end of the day, what we try to do basically is to find a place for the two narratives to coexist together, next to each other. And I believe personally, if both sides recognize the narrative of each side with all the pain that comes with that, I am aware of that, the practical solutions will be much easier.
That was Maya Katz and Suleiman Khatib, Israeli and Palestinian members of Combatants for Peace. For more information about the group's mission and work, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On October 5th, the U.S. and 11 other nations concluded negotiations on the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement that's designed to integrate 40% of the world's economy. The TPP, as it's known, must still be voted on by the U.S. Congress, where a broad coalition of labor, environmental, and consumer groups are working to defeat the controversial trade deal. While the final text of the agreement has not yet been made public, President Obama has maintained from the beginning of the negotiating process that the pact will include the strongest labor protections of any free trade agreement in history. But opponents who have seen leaked text of the agreement's provisions maintain that approval of the TPP will result in job loss, lower wages, and higher prices of pharmaceutical drugs. The divisive investor-state dispute settlement provisions of the TPP allow multinational corporations to challenge local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings, if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. Those claims would be adjudicated by unaccountable tribunals organized under the World Bank or the United Nations. Your reporter spoke with Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who explains why a growing coalition is opposed to the TPP and the next steps in the campaign to defeat the trade deal in Congress.
It's unclear exactly how final the deal is. We still don't know what's in the text. It hasn't been released, and President Obama has not actually yet announced to Congress of his intent to sign the agreement. But a big part, as I mentioned, of the reason they haven't been able to finish is because there's a lot of opposition to the deal, and a lot of the opposition stems from the fact that even though the TPP is billed as a free trade agreement, it's really about way more than what we think of when we think of typical trade issues such as tariffs and taxes on goods, etc. And actually, the vast majority of the TPP's contents really don't have anything to do with trade, then they have implications for a number of really important issues for citizens, such as, for example, the cost of medicines, you know, whether or not the environment is protected, labor issues, food safety, rollback of popular procurement programs, et cetera, among many other things. And it's also, the agreement has also garnered a lot of opposition because it's been negotiated completely in secret, and there's been no access for civil society in the press.
Would you address for our listeners some of the concerns that surround pharmaceutical intellectual property and the possibility that we'll see a spike in prices for basic medicines that people need to take?
This part of the negotiations, it's known as it's in the intellectual property chapter. The negotiations about the intellectual property chapter have turned out to be the biggest sticking point in the negotiations. Specifically, as you mentioned, the issue of the expansion of monopoly protections for big pharmaceutical companies. And this would actually increase the price of life-saving medicines because it would be expanding the length of patent terms. So basically blocking competition from a generic version of medicines and allowing these big companies to charge, you know, whatever they want. And more specifically, what's been a huge controversy in this agreement is the monopoly periods for biological medicines. So these are medical products that are actually derived from living organisms, and they're what are used to treat cancer. So we're talking about, you know, people who really, really need these medications and concerns about what the price of these life-saving medicines are going to be. And these increased drug prices also undermine other programs that are really important to try to keep medicine prices down in the U.S., such as Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Administration Program. I mean, this could mean increased costs for programs like PEPFAR, which is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, et cetera. So this is, you know, something that we don't typically think of as being part of a trade agreement, and it's really a life or death issue, you know, for a lot of people around the world. So that's definitely been one of the biggest controversies in the TPP.
Well, Jessa, lay out for our audience, if you would, the campaign underway now to defeat TPP in the U.S. Congress. There's limited time for debate, and no amendments are permitted under the fast-track provisions that were adopted by Congress several months back.
So the thing about the TPP is that, you know, it really can't become a reality unless it gets through U.S. Congress. And really, the TPP's fate in Congress is highly uncertain. And it's going to be a huge fight. And we saw a preview of this, as you mentioned, during the fast-track fight earlier this year. So fast-track, as you mentioned, the provision which really limits Congress's role in the matters of trade and makes it so that they can't make any changes. They have limited time for debate. They can only vote up or down. So that just barely eked through the Congress. There was a huge coalition of organizations talking about all the major labor unions, environmental groups, human rights groups, faith groups, people concerned about access to medicines and internet freedoms, a number of local groups down to the, you know, some of the huge groups were working together to fight against the fast track. And it was a very, very close fight, but actually, now those organizations that were working on that issue have turned their attention to the TPP and are working to defeat the TPP. So under fast track, Obama has to give 90 days notice before Congress can vote on the TPP. So the very earliest that the TPP could come to Congress would be in early 2016, which is right in the middle of the election season. And, you know, we don't expect that members of Congress are really going to want to take such a controversial vote during the election season. In another kind of demonstration of how politically toxic this issue is, a number of presidential candidates are coming out against the TPP, most notably Hillary Clinton. After supporting the TPP as Secretary of State, has come out against the TPP, also Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Martin O'Malley, and some other Republican presidential candidates expressing kind of skepticism as well. So it's very, very clear that there's going to be a huge fight, and the TPP's fate really is uncertain in the U.S. Congress. So, I mean, it's really important for people that are, you know, concerned about the TPP. The fight is far, far from over. It's really important for everyone to contact their elected officials and just let them know that they should oppose the TPP.
That was Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. For more news and commentary on the battle to defeat the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since well before Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, Republican and conservative politicians have railed against corporate taxes, arguing that U.S. tax rates hurt the American economy and put a damper on the creation of jobs. By statute, profitable corporations are supposed to pay a 35% federal income tax rate on their U.S. profits. But in 2010, corporations based in the U.S. had an effective federal tax rate of just 13% on their worldwide income, 17% when state and local taxes are included. Corporations are paying a smaller share of federal tax revenue now than they did in the 1950s, dropping from one-third then to only one-tenth of the total today. Meanwhile, corporate lobbyists are stalking the halls of Congress, advocating legislation that would lower the U.S. corporate income tax rate from the current 35% to 25%, leaving middle-income taxpayers to make up the difference in lost revenue. Now, a new study published by Citizens for Tax Justice and the U.S. Public Interest Research Group Education Fund, titled Offshore Shell Games 2015, reveals that nearly three-quarters of U.S.-based Fortune 500 companies transferred $2.1 trillion in profits to offshore tax havens in 2014. By offshoring their profits, these companies avoided paying an estimated $620 billion in federal taxes if they were subject to paying the full rate. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Gardner, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a contributor to the report, who summarizes the findings and urges Congress to take action on tax reform measures to ensure corporations pay their fair share of taxes.
The basic idea of the report, the question we're trying to answer, is we know that there are headlines of big companies avoiding taxes by shifting their profits offshore. And we wanted to take a look at how widespread this is. So we looked at the Fortune 500 overall, looked at the annual financial reports, and what we found is that the vast majority of Fortune 500 corporations are now holding subsidiaries in known foreign tax havens. We take this as an indicator that offshoring of profits, sending profits out of the U.S. into beach island tax havens like the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, is not only growing, but it's near and universal among multinational corporations. Everybody does it.
Could you give us some examples of the major multinational corporations based here in the United States and the kinds of money we're talking about that they squirrel away overseas and do not pay into the federal tax coffers?
Sure. I'll start with the big picture. We know that these companies, Fortune 500 overall, have disclosed having $2.1 trillion in cash that they're stashing offshore and that they claim they're never bringing back. There may be more. That's just what they've disclosed. The single biggest company on this list is Apple, which says that it has $180 billion in offshore cash. That's the top of the list. You have companies like American Express, Nike, Pfizer, Morgan Stanley, Pepsi. And what you can hear just from that list is that this isn't, it's not a tech sector problem. It's not a bank problem. It's something that virtually everyone in every economic sector is now dabbling in. So there's an awful lot of money at stake. One thing that's striking is how heavily concentrated these profits are in the hands of a small number of corporations. As I said, Apple, you know, you're looking at something like 10% of the entire offshore stash right there. Pfizer, American Express, these few drug companies really are a pretty big chunk of the total as well. So while a lot of the people are doing it, a very small group of the very biggest corporations are the ones who are really benefiting the most from this.
Tax avoidance is not a zero-sum game. Somebody's got to pay the negative fallout, right? Explain to our audience, who pays the price for the corporate tax avoidance in terms of the revenues that are missing from federal coffers?
It's a great question, and it's a great question to start with, I think, because I think part of the reason why lawmakers fall prey to this idea that we have to cut corporate taxes is because they're sold this argument that corporate tax cuts are free, that they will pay for themselves. In fact, they don't. After decades, there's no evidence at all that cutting any taxes, let alone corporate taxes, results in economic benefits that offset the revenue loss, you got to pay for them. And when you have a system in place where it's the biggest multinationals that are reaping all these benefits from tax avoidance, inevitably that means one of two things has to happen in order to approach balancing our federal budgets. One is we could hike taxes on everybody else. Everybody else means small businesses that don't have the luxury of hiring expensive lobbyists to get these tax breaks enacted, and that don't have high-profile accountants to help them shift their profits offshore. And of course, the other possibility is people like us, middle-income families, low-income working families. These are the folks who, in the end, are holding the bag when these big multinationals avoid hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes.
Matt, there is a way forward for Congress to take action to rein in this widespread corporate tax avoidance. Lay out for us the political will that will be necessary to move legislation forward to end the incentives for corporate offshore depositing of these large sums of money, and also to get that money back into the United States.
What could allow Congress to have the political will is that the politics are absolutely on the side of revenue-raising reform. If you ask people what makes them most angry about the tax system, they're not mad that their taxes are too high. They're not mad about the way they deal with the tax system. They're mad because they perceive correctly that corporations, that the best-off individuals are getting away with it, that they're not paying their fair share, and that they're shifting their tax load, these corporations, onto the rest of us. That's what makes people mad. And they're furious about the notion that General Electric can earn $4 billion a year and not pay any income taxes on it at all. They're furious about this. So if Congress ever catches up with what the American people actually believe on this issue, revenue-raising corporate tax reform will be right around the corner. I just think it's a case where there is now this disconnect between what Congress is hearing from corporate lobbyists and what the public is saying.
That was Matthew Gardner, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. To access a copy of the Offshore Shell Games 2015 report and related analysis, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.